What's going on, everyone? It's the After the Snow podcast back at you. Another episode, another week. Your co-host, Dave Mays, and alongside me, the one and only.
Freeway Ricky Ross.
No question.
What's up, Dave?
Rick, what's the word?
Man, we back at it again.
Yeah, man. That's what we do. Getting our,
no doubt. No doubt.
Getting a good rhythm going.
Yes, yes. Busy again this weekend, man. Another busy weekend. I was in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that. Tell us about the Lou. How are they doing out there?
Big turnout. Big turnout. A lot of good fights. Saw a couple guys that I really like. You know, hopefully I can get them signed up, help them with their career, get them moving forward. But it was really nice, man. I had a great time in the Lou. Saw some old friends from high school. You know, the Lou was the first place that ever arrested me for selling drugs.
Really? Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was the first place to ever arrest me for selling drugs. So
how did that happen? And when?
I think that might have happened like 84, 83. You know, I went down there and, you know, kilos were selling for like $64,000 a kilo. So I was going to make the Lou home.
Oh, that's what they were paying in St. Louis, $64,000. Wow.
Yeah, that was good money. You know, I was killing the game with that one. So, you know, I got me a little condo down there, was going to move in and, you know, had a little incident. You know, the cops in L.A. raided my girl's house and she was crying, and you know, even though I got her right out of jail, she was still crying and wanted me to come home. So I still had about 4 kilos left, you know, when that happened down in St. Louis. And I was keeping them, you know, I used to keep all my dope in the trunk of a car. But my boy who I'm down there with, his dad had saw the car I was driving, you know, it was just a bucket, you know, something I just got just for right there. Mm-hmm. And his dad saw the car and he just loved the car, right? So I said, well, man, when I finish with it, you can have this car. So when I jump on the plane and go back to Cali, my boy take the 4 kilos that I had left in the trunk of the car out the car and put them in his house. And then he had a partner that played for the St. Louis Cardinals at the time. And the dude called him for an ounce of cocaine and he was setting him up with the police. So the police wound up raiding his house. They thought they were just raiding for 1 ounce of cocaine. But then when they searched the house, they found 4 kilos. So, you know, all hell broke loose.
Man. So you ended up getting charged. Were you able to beat that, or what happened?
Oh, yeah. I beat that case.
Yeah.
Yeah, I beat the case. That was no question. They didn't have no evidence on me. Only thing they had on me was a plane ticket. You know, I had a plane ticket that I had left in his house with my name on it. And, you know, so that threw me on the indictment. Okay. But he stood up. You know, he went to court, stood up, took his charges, you know, took everything, and everything worked out for me. But it was the first time that the feds had ever arrested me, period.
Oh, so it was a federal. So the feds were in St. Louis like that, like trying to, you know.
Well, you know, when you bring me involved in California and bringing it from California to St. Louis, you know, they just, you know, all that stuff just comes to play. So, but anyway, it was kind of like a homecoming for me, you know, going back to St. Louis.
Yeah, good.
I really like the place. You know, I like the people. A lot of cool folks, you know, and you know, treated me with a lot of love down there. Sold a few books, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it was a great time overall. I really enjoyed it. Can't wait to go back.
Okay.
Shout out to the Lou. The promoter, Dave, put on a great fight. Me and him are looking forward to doing some things in the future. And like I said, there's 4 fighters that I'm really interested in signing up.
Okay.
If at all possible. So that was my weekend this weekend, man.
All right. We were here in Chicago. You know, summertime shy is kicking off here finally. This is when things get, you know, much more exciting and lively in Chicago. And we were out on the lake Saturday night. They have fireworks out there every Saturday night. And a friend of ours took us out on their boat to watch the fireworks. That was pretty nice for me and Brett. And yeah, we were out on the Riverwalk the night before, which is a real nice area where the river runs through the middle of downtown. And yeah, man. So
you gonna be home on the 25th? I know I'm gonna be there on the 25th. We got an expungement clinic going on there again. So I'll be back in Chicago on the 25th. I think 25th, 26th.
Okay.
We'll be there doing expungement clinics, you know, where we help people get their records clean.
Okay. I should be here, so I want to come out and join you when you do that here.
That'll be dope. That'll be dope. I'll be glad to have you out. You know, anytime we get to kick it is always, because, you know, we be going like,
all right.
You know, we all be right. Crossing each other in the air, man.
All right. Right, well, I'll be here. I go to L.A. on the 26th or the 27th. So hoping you'll be back in L.A. after that. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm gonna just do Chicago, and then I'm coming straight back. I should be here until the Essence. I'm going to the Essence Festival this year.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm gonna go down there and sell some books.
Yeah, New Orleans.
Yeah, New Orleans. See what that's like, man.
Have you been to Essence Fest?
Never been there. But, I've been to New Orleans a few times. I love New Orleans. You know, yeah. I got some great friends there. I also got a couple fighters, you know, that I work with down there. Alvin Vermeer out of there. And another guy that I've been talking to, Silk. Great fighter, you know. I'm hoping that me and him can do some business.
Okay.
I'm really getting heavy in this fight game, man. This thing is really, really picking up, Dave.
Yes, it's exciting to see it happen, man.
And I'm enjoying it, you know, just,
yeah.
Fighting is so, it's a brutal sport, you know, real brutal. You know, it's for people who like to see blood and like to see two guys go at it, man, and you know, see who's the most dominant. So, I'm cool with that part of it, but what I really like is the people in the game, you know, the ones that I believe I'm going to be able to help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's up. That's what's up, man. Glad that's moving forward and you're building momentum with that. So, you know.
Yes. You ready to get on with this show, man? That's enough about what I've been doing, man. And
Yeah.
You know, but I just been excited, man. You know, life has been so good. You know, coming from where I come from, man, when you've been sitting up in them boxes and you can't do nothing, and now you're out here and you're really getting to see the fruits of your labor, you know, materialize. It's a wonderful thing, man. So
yeah,
I just be excited.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit about Snowfall season 1, episode 7 we're up to. So we're getting, you know, into the final stages of the first season. The title of this episode is Cracking. So, you know, this is a pivotal episode where they go to Oakland and, you know, they discover crack and how to make it. So we want to talk about that, but you know, that's really the big.
There's some interesting stuff happening in here, man. This guy Franklin, man. Either he's naive, or the fucker's heart is as big as the Empire State Building, man. Because he be doing some shit. He be all over the place, man. This dude takes so many chances, man. You know, like. He does stuff that we never would have done in the dope game. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. Nowhere do you do some of the things that he's done. You know?
He stays walking around with a backpack full of kilos by himself all over the, you know, the country, wherever.
Don't know nobody.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? He ain't got a clue where he's going. And, you know, he's just off, man. And you know, but one of the things that really got me and You know, and this is the last episode that we watched, you know, and I just can't stop thinking about, like, there's no black that lives in L.A. would have went to East L.A. trying to sell a Mexican gang no cocaine.
Right.
Without an introduction. I mean.
Right.
You know, you can go to those places, but you can't go over there just like no random motherfucker pulling up in their hood. Man, that just don't happen, man.
Right.
You know, anybody. And that's why I say he had to be naive, but, you know, his heart just had to be, you know, he should have had him a bazooka in the car.
you would think he had that everywhere, the way he goes around, man.
Man. I mean, and then the guy already told him that they killed his partner, you know, like, you know, he should have at least been telling, dude, man, let me give you $3,000 to walk me to the door, you know, to take me over there and personally introduce me to guarantee my safety. Because, right. you know, without those kind of measures, you know, there's no guarantee of your safety, you know. So when I see the way this guy, you know, walks around and he tries to sell this cocaine, I'm like, ooh, wee, this is amazing.
Before we get into what happens in Oakland when they get there, you know, we're seeing also and Lucia, okay, they brought the kilos over to the Mexicans. They got their money. They're back home celebrating, taking shots. And, you know, of course, they end up, you know, getting it in. Pedro shows up and peeps what's going on and dips out of there, so they don't know he saw them or heard them. But so their relationship is growing, you know, into something obviously personal as well as business. So I was thinking of talking a little bit about that, like, you know, mixing personal and business. You know, did that happen to you?
All the time. Yeah. That happens all the time, you know, especially with me, you know. I didn't mind being personal with the people that I work with. You know, I found out it's sometimes it's better and safer, you know, if the person that you're working with really has a genuine affection for you as a person outside of the money, it makes it a little better, you know, and it can cause problems as well. But when you got people who really understand the streets, you know, and they understand the street code. One thing that we don't do is we don't bring the police in our business, you know, no matter what happens, the police stay out of it. It usually works pretty well.
Now, how about with women? Like, you know, did you have a lot of women just kind of coming at you, obviously, because they know about your money and how, you know, how much you got going on?
They did, you know, when you know, you figure when you're in South Central, especially during this time, the average person with a great job in South Central at that time made about $300 or $400 a week. And I'm talking about that was like considered a great job. If I would have got one of those jobs, I never would have been selling dope, right? So now you're talking about somebody that's just at the low stage is making $10,000 a week, you know, with no job, you know, no kids, no responsibility, you know, just $10,000 is coming in every single week. You know, women take notice of that. You know, one of the most things that I found out about most women is they're looking for security first and foremost. You know, if you can offer a woman security, she'll take you if you're a little ugly, you know. I was telling some of my friends a joke one time. It was this young lady. She was dancing on Soul Train. I'm talking about drop dead gorgeous chick. And one of my partners, we used to call him Stanky, you know, because he didn't bathe.
Oh, man, what's going on with Stanky?
But he got rich, you know. Yeah. He got rich enough that he had the slant nose Porsche Turbo. He had the big body Benz. you know, he had the toys. Well, and he had her riding around with him. So when you see that, you like, you know, for that security and for that money, you know, women are doing. Because I rode in the car with him one time. And I said, I'll never ride in there with him again. You know, I had to let my window down, stick my head out the window.
Oh, my God. Where's the air freshener?
Yeah. But women would just get in there and ride with him, you know, yeah. As if they couldn't smell it, you know. So when you're talking about women and attraction of wealth, women are attracted by wealth. You know, different things, you know, brilliance and selling drugs is a form of being brilliant, you know, in my personal opinion. I used to didn't think so. But now that I'm older and wiser and I sit back and I watch these young guys and what they do, and I understand the brilliance in their trade.
Yeah. So they take the road trip to Oakland. Kevin's cousin is supposedly the man up there. So Franklin and Leon and Kevin take the road trip. They pull up to this kind of after hour spot late at night, kind of a rough looking spot. And they go in, you know, a little nervous, you know, they got these 2 kilos in the backpack and, you know, but Kev says, don't worry, this is my family. We'll be good. So they, you know, they go on in there. They meet his cousin. His cousin, who's played by someone that you know.
That's my man, Red Grant.
Yes. We got a couple cameos in this episode. But, yeah, let's talk about Red, who pops up as the cousin in Oakland. How long you been knowing Red?
Well, you know, I met Red a couple weeks after I was out. One of my guys talked me into going to a comedy show in North Hollywood. And when I got there, Red Grant was the host, and you know, and I just fell in love with his comedy. You know, he was marking the rappers. You know, he was rapping the rapper song about selling cocaine and blah blah blah. And then when he saw me in the audience, I mean, it just, you know, it was like bam, you know, like connection. We just hooked up from that day on, man, and we've been rocking. You know, even. It's been times, you know, I gave him a few of my T-shirts when my T-shirt first came out. And I come into, he was hosting the Laugh Factory in Hollywood one day. And I walk in and he got on my T-shirt. And him and Cat Williams, you know, Cat bought about 50 books, you know, gave everybody in the building a book. And, you know, we just been rocking ever since, man. I tried to get him today. He didn't pick up the phone. You know, he's running for mayor in D.C., so. Probably got a busy schedule right now, trying to become the mayor of D.C. But I definitely would love to get him on the show and have him sit down with us and just tell us a little bit about what he thought about the show.
Yeah, shout out to Red Grant, man. And I didn't know he was running for mayor. So, yeah, that's big.
Yeah. Running for the mayor. So when I saw him in the show, it really surprised me because I didn't know. You know, I haven't paid any attention to this show before.
Right.
Before you brought me on board with this here. I had totally been boycotting the show. I didn't want to know who played what role. I don't want to know who directed. I don't want to know who wrote. I didn't want to have nothing to do with this show, man.
Right.
But now, you know, that I'm watching and I'm seeing people that I know on there, you know, it's kind of. Yeah, you know, it's cool.
Yeah. So, you know, this place, they're waiting around. The cousin is waiting for his guy, Little Joe. And there's a lot of wild stuff going on. They want to party. Kev wants to, you know, Franklin sees Kev taking a little bit of the coke. You know, he's telling me he wants to, you know, play around with some of these chicks. And Franklin's getting frustrated. You know, he's there. He wants to try to do business. And
Franklin want to just do business and leave.
Right.
He's trying to sell his coke and get out of there.
Right.
Which I don't blame him.
Right. he didn't want no parts of all the dice games and all the other activities going on at the spot. So he ends up just rolling out, and there he is.
Well, you know, before that, though, remember the big chick, she tries to get the backpack from him.
Oh, yes, he did run up on him.
And he's like, what's with that backpack?
Right.
I mean, I'm you know what's crazy? You know what's crazy? And I just popped in my head. Man, people wasn't even carrying backpacks back in the
80s. Right. I don't remember that either. Like,
man, nobody wasn't wearing backpacks back then. You know, backpacks is a kind of a new thing.
Right. But there he goes, man, off and running, just walking the streets of Oakland in the middle of the night with his backpack of 2 kilos, walking all over the place.
And then he winds up in a vacant building.
Right.
And he follows a chick through the building, not knowing, I done been to some vacant places, because I like to buy, houses and buildings like that, and refurbish them and stuff. But I'm always a little cautious about going into places where there's homeless people at, because mm-hmm. you never know what you might run into,
Right.
I done went into the homeless places and one of them got a gun.
Yeah.
So to see him venturing off the way, like I told you earlier, either his heart is just ginormous or he's a total idiot or naive about the ways of the world and the ways of this drug trafficking business that he's venturing into.
Right. Well, to his credit, he kind of says that later on in the episode when he hooks up with the RZA. One of the other cameos in this episode, he says something like, maybe I'm just crazy, but I gotta learn about this. So before he gets to the RZA, he's in the vacant building, abandoned building that turns out to be one of the former Black Panther headquarters in Oakland, because he remembers the place, or at least he thinks it's the same place. And he's having memories of visiting his dad up there.
He was having the flashbacks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, that part was cool, but it still doesn't neglect how naive he is to be walking around with 2 kilos of cocaine in a backpack. You talking about mid-80s, easily $50,000-$60,000 worth of dope, I know in there they were saying he was getting them for $16,000 a kilo at one time, but right. that's a low price, and that's a price that somebody probably buying 100 kilos would get,
Right.
When I started getting them for 16, I had to be buying at least 100 kilos, maybe 150 kilos at a time. When I was only buying 1 and 2, they was like $45,000-$48,000 a piece.
Yeah.
So you're talking about he's walking around with a lot of dope. And yeah. I don't know, if I would have been going to a new place like that, I would have took what we call a sample, maybe a couple ounces out, right. Something that I could afford to lose. Or to give away.
Yeah. So he's running around and he meets this lady. She's smoking a crack, like a crack pipe, or freebasing maybe. I'm not sure what it was. But he's like, man, I never seen nothing like this before. Where'd you get that? And he has it taken to her dealer, and he buys all the dealers' stock of the crack rock. When he runs up on the dealer's like, rock, it's rocked up, it's cocaine, it's rocked up. And Franklin's like, oh man, what is that? And and then he convinces the dealer to take him to the guy that actually makes the crack rock, which turns
in a couple of those scenes, what he did was normal, what could happen in that type of incident. Another point I want to make is that back then nobody was using cigarette lighters. to smoke crack with. Everybody was using a ROM 151. That's how they smoked their cocaine. So they got their timing off a little bit. You know, it's like they went from the 90s and brought it back to the 80s. If you understand what I'm saying, they started smoking with cigarette lighters. And that's when it really got bad. When people were really like, didn't have time. They didn't want to wait to get their rum, because when they smoke it with the rum 151, they get a cleaner taste from what I've been told. You know, I never tried it either way, but what I was told is that when you smoke it with the rum 151, the taste is cleaner and it's more pure. You know, with that cigarette lighter, they were saying there's something about the taste that wasn't there. So they jumped ahead of themselves, you know, when they implemented the cigarette lighters in there. But when he offers the lady, you know, to buy her a rock to go and meet her connect, that's something that definitely happens in the drug business all the time.
So he ends up in some kind of laboratory room with the RZA, who's playing on an old piano and talking a bunch of shit. And, you know, Franklin is trying to convince him to teach him what he's doing. And of course, he opens the backpack up, shows him two keys. That's when he's like, you know, I might be taking a big risk, you know, doing this, but it's worth it. I got stuff I'm trying to do. I need to know what this is. And he says, you know, I look at you as an artist. You're, you know, creating something. And, you know, artists like to have their creations and their visions spread to the world. So, you know, I'm going to be the guy that can take your creation and spread it down to LA and so on. That's his pitch to the RZA. And the RZA goes for it. He decides to teach him how to make the crack rock.
Yeah, right. For free.
For free. Just because Franklin was a nice guy.
Yeah, for free, man. I wish it was that easy. I wish it was that easy, man. You know, they charged me so much to teach me how to cook, man. I paid one guy like $80,000, $75,000. Then I paid another guy about $65,000. Then I paid another guy like $30,000 to eventually, you know, get different recipes. My initial learning how to cook it up, just straight cocaine, you know, I should pay guys $200, $300, you know, to cook it up for me, but never free.
Right. So, but this is the big question that I have, which is, you know, where did crack originate? Was it in Oakland? And how did you first learn about it, and where, and how to make it? That's a big question that a lot of people want to know.
Well, a lot of people have been trying to, I mean, you know, Gary Webb tried to figure that out. Michael Levine, you know, he tried to figure it out, said that he had the answer, that it come from one of the Colombian countries. But I don't think nobody really knows the exact answer to that question, you know, because it spread it so far and so fast. Now, you know, L.A., we were the biggest crack era, you know, area in the beginning of the epidemic. But that don't mean that it started here. You know, it could have started somewhere else. Just it caught fire here faster than it did in Oakland. I'm not for sure.
Okay. So you didn't go to Oakland and find out about it?
No. They were already doing it. When I started, they had already, you know, like I said, they had been Ether Basin for a while. Okay. You know, when I got started, you know, Richard Pryor and a bunch of other people had been what they call Ether Basin. Now, when I got there, they had just started playing around with cooking it with baking soda and It was something else they used to put in it. What was that called? It was something else they used to put in it that would make it rock, but it gave it a nastier taste than the baking soda. So it was already there, but like I said, it was just a few people doing it. When I got started, it was really the elite that was really fee-based. And it wasn't the everyday person. You know, the everyday person couldn't afford it. Remember, I told you when I first started, a gram of cocaine was about $325-$350 for 1 gram.
Yeah. So what was the first time you saw a crack rock? Because there's the free basin, but at some point it transitions to the crack rocks. When was the first time?
I saw rock almost immediately, you know, almost the same time I saw cocaine. You know, my boy gave me the cocaine. I took it. And a day or so, you know, I was with Martin and he was cooking that shit up. You know, he was turning it into rock.
Okay, so Martin was somebody, he already knew how to do that.
Yeah. Martin was a pimp. Martin was he was one of the big homies, but you know, he was a pimp. And I guess you could say he was my first customer. He was my very first customer, even though he didn't pay me for the rock that, you know, the bag that I gave him. He brought Big Mouse back to me. And that was what kicked my business off. Had he not brought Big Mouse to me, I don't know if I would have been a cocaine dealer.
So now who's Big Mouse?
Big Mouse was, he ran with Tookie and Jamel, you know, big swole dude, had about some 22, 23 inch arms, you know, was a crip, a pimping crip. Remember, the only people that could afford it at this time was like people who were getting some real money. Yeah. You know, you couldn't be no chump smoking cocaine.
Right.
So you know, Mouse was a pimp or a halfway pimp, you know, just like Martin was. But they was playing with cocaine.
So
nobody really knew at that time that it was addictive. You know, it wasn't, you know, they wasn't selling their cars. They wasn't taking off their jewelry. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't like that at that time. This is like, you know, they hit it tonight, you know, at the end of the night, they hit it maybe tomorrow, you know, more or less like that, you know, not like it became. You know, Martin and Mouse eventually became addicts, you know, where they no longer was pimping and all they wanted to do was stand on the block and hustle rocks for the young boys.
Yeah, man. Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so it really broke them down.
So how quickly did you kind of see your business transforming from just the coke you were selling at first to really the crack? And was it the crack that really helped expand it to a much bigger business for you?
Yeah. Well, what happened is I have been selling the coke, but I didn't know how to cook it. So what they would do is they would cook it for themselves. But what happened is I peeped a game that people would come by my house at 6 a.m. and they wanted to get a blast before they go to work. So some of them would be like, oh, man, I left my utensils at the house. You know, they cooking utensils because they used to cook it up right in their car with 151 rum. They would actually take a torch and they would be in their car cooking, rocking the coke, because they you could rock it up with the rum too. You know, the 151 rum was like a part of the game. You know what I'm saying? Mm. They probably made so much money off the cocaine business. You know, like another one of those incendiary companies that benefited, just like baking soda. You know, baking soda benefited from the coke game. So people would be sitting in their car at 6 a.m. cooking up cocaine. So what came to my mind is, why not already have it cooked for them? And that's when we started the term ready rocked, you know, meaning that it's already rocked up. You ain't got to rock it up. Mm. All you got to do is store it on your pipe. So once we did that, the business really started picking up because, you know, some people still didn't know how to cook. Mm. And a lot of people were scared to cook it because they were scared of messing it up. You know, it was a thing where people, like when I first started, they had me believing that if I tried to cook it and I didn't know what I was doing, I could just ruin the whole cocaine where it would just evaporate and be gone.
Oh, man. Yeah, they didn't want you figuring it out.
Right. They didn't want they wanted you to keep paying them to do it. You know, right. That's how they made their little $200 or $300.
Right. Right. Interesting. Well, yeah, I think, you know, overall, this is the best part of this episode because it's kind of a slow episode. You know, it's not a lot of real action that happens. There's a lot. He spends a lot of time with the RZA and learning how to, you know, make the rock and all the RZA's telling him all this stuff. Shout out to the RZA, man. Another good look for hip hop in the show. Of course, RZA's been, you know, doing his thing in the acting world for a long time, not just the music. So shout out to RZA. Have you ever met RZA, any of the Wu-Tang?
Yep, I met RZA. It was some years ago when I met RZA. We were at some movie production company.
Okay.
And me and him, we spoke a few words. Yeah, Mecca, I'm mostly cool with Mecca and Redman, though. You know, they're my boys. You know, they both in the cannabis industry, too. So
that's right.
Everywhere I run into Mecca, though, he showed mad love. I ran into Mecca in Oregon at a festival. And we went back to the hotel and we bought some champagne bottles and just kicked back, man, and had a good time. Last time I saw Redman, though, we spoke at a college in New Jersey. I can't even think of the name of it. Might have been Orban or something like that university. But we spoke on the same panel back there. So, yeah, I know a few of Wu-Tang.
Shout out Redman. Shout out Newark, his hometown. Yes, yes. But, yeah, man.
And so, talking about them, you know, I was with Griselda. You know, I was on stage with Griselda about a week and a half ago. You know, Griselda had me on stage with my man Jay Worthy. And to me, they remind me of Wu-Tang.
Right. Yeah, they do. They do have a lot of, you know, influence from Wu-Tang and, you know, especially Raekwon, Ghostface. And they show love. They've talked about that. But, yeah, Griselda's, you know, they're doing their thing, really bringing, you know, another element into hip-hop, you know, at a high level. They've really been the driving force of, like, bringing some of that kind of classic hip hop feel, you know, back into the current day music. Those guys from Buffalo.
Sold out crowd. I mean, it was jam packed in there, man. No space, nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I met Raekwon too. Me and Raekwon, we cool too.
The chef.
Yeah, shout out. I forgot about Ray. You know, be so many people, man, that you can't remember them all.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think we can wrap up this week, man. You know, we'll be back next week. You know, like I said, this episode, that was really the main thing that ends with Franklin coming back with a bag of crack rock all cooked up. He's all excited about it. But Leon and Kev are pissed at him because he wasn't there when the big man showed up, and they don't understand it. He said, look, this is our future right here, and they get on the road.
He got it. He got it. He said he got it.
Exactly.
He don't need the big man. He the big man now. RZA gave it up for free.
Exactly.
No deal in place.
Yeah. So any last thoughts before we sign off, Rick?
Well, you know, I'm anxious to see where they go from here. You know, we see them in the projects giving out free rocks. You know that.
Yeah.
I was wondering how much did they give out? Did they give away the whole 2 keys? You know. But I see them in the projects giving out the free rocks. You know, to a certain extent, that's something that could happen. You know, when you give out samples to get people started.
Yeah.
But I'm interested to see where it goes from here. You know, how well the riders are familiar with the drug culture, as well as South Central LA.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we know you know that stuff better than anyone, you know, when it comes to South Central LA and in the 80s. So, man, just glad to have you doing this podcast and bringing that knowledge and expertise to the world. And, you know, I hope and I'm sure that our fans, our listeners and our viewers appreciate it and appreciate you as well.
Well, you know, sometimes you need some eyes of somebody who's been there so they can catch the things that these writers are not really paying attention to. You know, it's very easy to add a cigarette lighter to a time, you know, that there was no cigarette lighters and people will just let it go by, you know. But that was really an intricate part of the game, because I remember precisely around the time that people started using cigarette lighters, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just like catching things like that, you know, and try to bring them to everybody's attention so everybody go, oh, yeah, you're right. Wasn't nobody having no cigarette lighters during that time. They wasn't using cigarette lighters during that time. So, you know, it's very important that we keep the history and don't rewrite it.
That's right. That's right. So this is After the Snow. This is the Snowfall After Show podcast. And we're doing season one of Snowfall right now. So we'll be back next week talking about episode 8. But thank everybody for checking us out. And much love.
Peace.
Peace.